God is great all of the time. We a couple of announcements. We are changing the order of things. Tomorrow, Russ and I are going to open in the morning. Russ will be first on in the morning, and then I'll be on second service, and then tomorrow night we will finish off. So that gives time for those people that you may be thinking about. You can tell them that tomorrow morning they'll get a sample of what to expect for the finish. But what I wanted to talk about, Russ is going to talk about, you know, the age of the earth and the flood. And yesterday I talked about the flood and what that would mean to this planet. And that was one of those areas as a secular humanist that I would have no flexibility whatsoever and never allowed the idea of a worldwide flood to permeate into my science for a couple of reasons. First of all, the dating procedures are really dependent on there not having been an all-encompassing flood because, as I said yesterday, you know, carbon-14 cannot date rock, and it can't date in the million years. But the rock we can date using radioisotopes depends on the fact that it was never contaminated. So the flood would have caused tremendous tectonic upheaval. And so when I heard the students, they said, well, you know, what about a flood? You know, and I said, well, it was a, even after I became a Christian and a theistic evolutionist, I kind of adhered to that localized flood. You know, the world in those days was the Mesopotamia Valley, so that was where the flood was. But then it started to dawn on me that if it was not a world-encompassing flood, then Noah was an idiot. Because how far can you walk in 120 years? Why build the boat if it was just a local flood? And then God says, you know, the rainbow is the covenant that it'll never happen again. Well, have we had local floods since? Yes. So it just didn't fit. But also, my trap of telling the students, well, it's obvious the Bible's wrong. Just look at the earth. It's obvious that it's old. Based on what? See, I'm looking at the fall. And if this flood was all-encompassing, the tectonic upheaval would have stressed this planet beyond belief. So it was like my friend I told you from Vietnam. I walked right past him in the hospital. Here he was, 20 years old, and he looked like he was 80. He had pure white hair. But he had been a prisoner of war and gone through a very traumatic experience. Why? Stress. So when I look at the earth, I don't see obvious age. I see stress. I see this planet recovering from the stress of a flood. But I thought this was interesting. In Job, 12:15, it says, behold, he withholdeth the waters, and they dry up. Also, he sendeth them out, and they overturn the earth. See, God has talked about the flood, not only just in the beginning, but he also, in Job, God tells Job that he says, you know, he, God, has determined the bounds of the waters, where they will come. You know, the waters ran off of the planet after the flood into the basins he prepared for them. And he says, this far your proud waves will come and no further. So that again goes right in the direct face of this global warming. You know, the ice is all melting and the planet's going to be flooding. Well, no. And by the way, do you know that we have maps and drawings of Antarctica with no ice on it? How did that happen? You see, so people say, well, look at the glaciers and the Himalayas. Look at these pictures. Well, what they show you is that, you know, 10 years ago, the glaciers were bigger and further. Now they've melted back. But what they don't show you is that 45 years ago, they were even further back. You see, these are the things that are manipulated. I talked about Mount St. Helens last night, just briefly. But that was the final blow. As I told you, I didn't accept Christ till 1987, 1 month after my 40th birthday. My biology had started to give me grief, as I told you. You know, Darwin was wrong, all of the little things. And every time I looked in the microscope, I had to walk away and convince myself that what I was looking at was not designed. Now, isn't that interesting? You would think if I just took it at common sense, it screamed design. It was so precise and so perfect. So things were starting to unravel. Well, then in 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. I was there. I had friends that were there. In fact, volcanoes don't sneak up on you, so we knew something was going to happen. It had given us plenty of warning. And so scientists from around the world had swooped in on Mount St. Helens. We had the National Geologic Survey had a headquarters set up at Vancouver, which was about 120 miles away. We actually had an observatory point with scientists staying weeks at a time on this ridge that's now called Johnson Ridge, which is 5 miles away from the volcano and 1,400 feet high. They set that observation post there because they figured that that would be a safe zone if something drastic happened. But see, again, we missed, you know, trying to outguess God. We didn't realize is that magma was forcing its way up in this lava chamber that was weakening the mountain. At first, we noticed that the mountain was bulging at a few centimeters per day. But the last week, prior to the eruption, it was bulging at over 50 feet per day. In fact, it looked like a pregnant mountain at the end. So on the morning of May 18th, at 17 seconds past 8:32 in the morning, I'll never forget that date, there was a 5.1 earthquake right at the base of the Mount St. Helens. And what that did is because the mountain had been so stressed and weakened, that the entire north face slid. It was the largest landslide in recorded history. It was over a half a cubic mile of debris. Not square mile, cubic mile. That's so much debris your mind can't get around it. Almost 4,000 feet of elevation slid off that mountain. And what happened then is because that north face slid, you had this horseshoe shape. The blast that followed was directed straight north, right at that observation post where David Johnson was. David was a young geologist, and he was out there on this ridge because he's a nice guy. He really wasn't supposed to have been out there. There was another scientist that had been out there. His name was Harry Glickin. And Harry had been out there for about a week, and it was cold and wet and miserable up there at Mount St. Helens. And there were no roads. Everything had to be either you had an excruciating hike or airlift the equipment up. So Harry had been out there, no hot shower, no, you know, bed for a week. And on Saturday, a group of us scientists were headed to Vancouver to the headquarters, decided to stop there to see where we would be coming back to, because we were going to be coming over and taking over the observation on Sunday morning. So when we stopped, Harry greeted us, and Dave Johnson says, "Hey, I got an idea." Because he saw Harry was, you know, pretty ragged looking, hadn't had a hot meal and a shower and a warm bed for a while. He says, "Harry, why don't you go on into the headquarters, because we're coming back tomorrow anyway. And I'll stay here tonight, and if anything happens, I'll be able to, you know, be the observer." So Harry says, "You bet." He jumps in the helicopter, and away we went. But see, had that volcano blown up on Saturday, it would have killed thousands of people. Because The governor had succumbed to the pressure from people wanting to go into the area, you know, checking property they hadn't seen in 100 years, but people wanted to, you know, there's something, you know, that draws you to the area. So the governor allowed people to go inside the red zone. So there were thousands of people went in. The Forest Service and the Sheriff's Department got them all herded back out on Saturday night. But if it had waited till Monday morning to blow instead of Sunday, there would have been thousands of people killed. Because Weyerhaeuser had scheduled 3,000 loggers to come in to do a logging operation on Monday morning. See, God didn't want any to perish. But as it was, 57 people died on the morning of May 18th. But had that volcano waited 5 more minutes, see, we were flying from Vancouver down there to be with David Johnson. We would have been there. As it was, the blast from the helicopter and the concussion, or from the volcano, pushed the helicopter sideways. There was an airplane flying around with two scientists, Dorothy and Keith Stovall. They almost were blown out of the sky as well. Harry, who was in the helicopter, just freaked out because he knew he should have been there, not David. So it was really interesting. In fact, he went into a state of clinical depression, and he was his doctor finally told him he had to go back and get back to doing something. He was, you know, he was driving himself into the ground. So Harry decided to join a team of scientists, a volcanologist, and went down to 6 months later, went down to Japan, where the day he got there on that volcano, he was killed. God has a plan, his timing. You'll hear again, I'm going to show the eruption again for those who didn't see it, and you'll see what David Johnson saw coming right at him. He had the radio, and we think he was running, trying to get down behind. We don't know. We never found any trace of him or the equipment. But you hear his last words, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." And that was it. And then over the next 7 years of in-my-face research is when my geology started to crumble, and that's when I finally realized that science doesn't have the answers. You know, because we observed a canyon carved at Mount St. Helens. It's called the Little Grand Canyon. It's 150 feet deep. It's a quarter mile across and 15 miles long through solid bedrock in a matter of hours and days. See, if I hadn't seen that canyon carved, I would have said, and I came up on it later, I would have said it took millions of years for the water to have carved that canyon. No. We saw 600 feet of minute strata laid down in a 300-mile-an-hour blast that we would never have believed. We saw steam pit blasts with rail topography that I told my students took hundreds of thousands of water years of water erosion happen instantly from the pyroclastic debris that was on the snow and ice. It boiled the groundwater, and you'd have these huge steam blasts, and you'd have these pits that were 100 feet deep and a mile across. Instantly, not thousands of years. We saw coalification and fossilization, all of these things happening in a rapid time. So now I had to come to grips with, well, there goes my old age thinking as well as my biology. So it was a series of things, but it still took 7 years. But it's really interesting. Today, I don't know of any scientist in the world that believes that the Colorado River carved the Grand Canyon. I know there's probably some out there, but most scientists, if you read the geologic journals and so forth, they believe in something called the Missoula Flood. And that was a flood that was created by an ice dam during the Little Ice Age about 12,000 years ago. It blocked all this water up, and it slowly it melted and breached, and all that water came rushing down, and it carved the Grand Canyon and the Scablands. Well, I can think of another flood that could have done it. You see, we need to be open enough to extrapolate and be able to say, hey, there are alternatives. Now, when David Johnson saw that blast coming at him, what happened is the landslide traveled at 150 miles an hour completely across that 5 miles and up over that 1,400-foot ridge. But the blast that followed traveled at 300 miles an hour, and it outraced the landslide and incinerated everything. It leveled enough trees in 6 minutes to build 650,000 three-bedroom homes. 150 square miles of forest. Boom. And that was just a small volcano. So you're going to see what David Johnson saw coming at him, and then we'll talk a little more about it.
Vancouver! Vancouver! This is it!
And, see, that was Mount St. Helens on the morning of May 18th. On the morning, this is what it looked like. It was considered one of the most beautiful places on Earth. It was a perfect cinder cone volcano, which are the most dangerous kind, the stratovolcanoes. You know, like the Pacific Ring of Fire, like Mount Shasta, Mount Adams, Mount Hood, Rainier. All of these are stratovolcanoes. They produce a very explosive type of eruption, where the Hawaiian volcanoes are called shield volcanoes. They produce massive amounts of a very fluid, liquid magma that's beautiful, but it's nowhere near as explosive. So that's what it looked like on the morning when David Johnson woke up. This is what it looked like a week later. Total devastation. That was an old-growth forest. Hundreds of thousands of elk and animals were just wiped out. Here's kind of a, gives you a picture. You can see almost 4,000 feet of elevation left. And it slid across that valley at over 150 miles an hour. This is a picture. That's David Johnson. He was the young geologist. He was the one who was on the ridge. But like I said, 57 people died that morning. And one of them was this old crusty guy by the name of Harry Truman. Harry was a case. He was 84 years old. He told me I was a young whippersnapper and didn't know what I was talking about. Of course, I was in those days. But every word out of his mouth, every other word was a swear word. He was quite a guy. This is kind of gives you the picture. You can still see this was just a few days after the eruption. Here are some of the trees that were up close. They were just shattered, just blown apart. The ones that were further out were just laid over in a northward directed blast. And then when that pyroclastic debris went out, it went out almost, like I said, it covered 150 square miles, but it would go out so far, and some of the trees would be what's called standing dead. It would burn off one side, the other side was still green, and that's where it dissipated. But what was really interesting is the scientists that were interviewed. You know, anytime there's a major disaster, you know, they have these scientists, you know, making these crazy comments. And now remember, this was a long time before I became a Christian, and I watched this one scientist, and there was a couple environmental people. They were weeping, you know, the elk will never return their district. Guys, the elk were returning and giving birth to twins on the pumice plains within months. Yeah, and first of all, the elk are not they're a plains animal. They adapted to the forest, so they didn't have to have an old-growth forest. But that's other. But the scientist said that the biologic devastation was so severe, you saw that picture, that it would never recover. And if it did, it would be hundreds of years. Well, I don't know where that came from. In a matter of weeks and months, we started having plants. And see that picture back? That's Spirit Lake. Those are logs flowing. Over a million logs were washed onto that lake, because when that landslide left, half of it slid into Spirit Lake. It created a wave over 800 feet high. That wave raced across the lake, slammed into the bank on the other side, and when it came back, it dragged the logs with it, which again was a thing, I think God made a laboratory for us. Because this was declared a national monument, so they couldn't move anything. They couldn't put anything in there, couldn't plant any plants. They had to leave it as it is. So we had a natural laboratory. And we saw biologic recovery happening immediately. But then in 1992, I was invited to go. That's, again, 12 years after the eruption. And remember, I didn't accept Christ till 1987. So just a couple of years after I'd become a Christian, I was invited to go back into Mount St. Helens by a team of creation scientists led by Dr. Steve Austin. Well, Dr. Austin's a sly dog. And I should have been suspicious. Here, this great geologist is inviting me, this biologist, to go on this expedition. All he was carrying was a pointy little hammer. I found out he couldn't get permission to take a mule, so he took a biologist. See, look, I'm carrying the backpack. 60 pounds of this rock later, I found out why I got to go. He kept stuffing rocks in the backpack. I even carried his lunch. Shows how gullible I was. But it was quite a chance. Now, we're sitting here. See that behind there? You see that little waterfall? We stopped there, not because it was such a beautiful spot, but because we had to do everything by foot. As creationists, we were, first of all, it was a surprise we got permission to go in there. But we couldn't fly in. We couldn't leave any marks. It was crazy. And we had to hike in. So we had mapped our route. 3 days before we went, we had mapped the route we were going to go into the crater. That canyon right there and that waterfall was not there. That's how quickly the geologic events could happen. It was absolutely phenomenal. So we were sitting there having lunch, trying to figure out now what are we going to do? How are we going to figure this out? And we actually had to go find another route. So we had to hike down and around. And it was pretty excruciating. Even though it lost 4,000 feet of elevation, it was still 8,000 feet. And so it was a pretty rugged climb. But the whole reason we went back in there was to take samples of this rock. Now, remember I told you yesterday that I asked those scientists in this room, 600 scientists, how we date fossils, and they all said carbon-14. I had all of these kids. In fact, last week, kids come up and they said, well, Dr. Arnold, what do you think about this new Ardidipithecus, this new fossil the scientists found, and they carbon dated it at 4.4 million years. Guys, that is just breaks my heart. Carbon dating, carbon-14 cannot date fossils, and it's never been used to date fossils. It can only date artifacts. It can date real bone, real wood, real carbon-based items. But even if it could date a fossil, and by the way, the fossil means that the minerals have replaced the cells, turning it to rock. Once it fossilizes or petrifies, carbon-14 can't be used. The other problem is carbon-14, no scientist in the world, and as a secular humanist scientist, I never stretched carbon-14 past about 70,000 years. Some scientists stretch it out to 100, but I know of nobody that would stretch it further than that. No scientist in the world would ever even dream about using carbon-14 for a million years. So, do you see the problem? How do we get a date of 3.7 million for Australopithecus afarensis, as Russ was saying, Lucy? How do you get 4.4 for Australopithecus ramidus? How about 65 million for Jurassic? If carbon-14 can't give you million-year dates, and it can't date rock, do you see the problem? And the kids don't know this. That is just wrong. We use radioisotopes to date rock. You've all, I would suspect, heard of uranium. Uranium-238 is a radioactive element, the parent product. It decays over a given period of time into its daughter product, a non-radioactive element called lead. Potassium into argon, rubidium into strontium. These will be on the test, so I hope you're taking notes. These types of methods are used to date and get million-year dates on igneous rock. Great. Where are fossils found? Sedimentary rock. So we have a real problem here. There is no method on this planet or any other to date a fossil. Zero. We can date the closest igneous rock and then guess how old the fossil is. So, you know, if we find the igneous rock up here and we measure down and find the fossil 6 inches below, we date the igneous rock at 3 million, then we assume that this fossil is older, so it's 3.5 million. How empirical is that? And what if the rock had ever been contaminated? How do we know how much uranium, how much lead was in it when it formed? What about when it remelted? The magma, you see, these are all questions that are never addressed. But the reason we went in there to take samples of this lava dome, this dome right here, see, that's 1,000 feet high, 2,000 feet around. You can see the snow down here, but that's steam coming out of the top. It was still pretty risky going in there. But we took samples of this rock. It's called dacite, by the way. We watched it ooze up, slowly cool, and crystallized into this igneous rock called dacite. Well, we know how old it is. It's 12 years old. So now, over a period of 3 years of intense preparation, preparing the rock, sending it to 9 labs, the same labs I used as a secular scientist, we just sent them the rock and said, tell us how old it is. Very interesting. You see, that lava dome is empirical. We know how and when it got there. We took the sample, and again, it's really expensive to do. But Christians from around the world helped finance it, and we sent it to the labs. We got 9 dates. We sent it to 9 labs. 9 dates for this rock. Out of the 9 dates, now give or take a few years, you know, in geology, you got to give or take, you know, you got to have your fudge factor, but not millions of years. A million years is not acceptable. The youngest date we got for 12-year-old rock was 390,000. That was 1 out of 9. All of the rest were up to 2.7 million. So how accurate are those dating procedures? You see, so that is all we're telling people is to question. Now, as I told you, that was in 1992. Well, we were accused, you know, of being Christians and creationists, and obviously our science wasn't good. After they raked us over the coals checking our credentials, and they couldn't beat us on that, we had scientists from Harvard, from USC, University of Washington, so that really irritated them. So then they said we must have contaminated or done something, so we went back in and did it again. First time in my academic career I ever got the exact same results. But they went with us this time. Well, just a few months ago in August, Dr. Steve Austin got together, the team, that's Dr. Austin and myself, this was just in August. We decided to go back up there and see what else we could find, see how the Little Grand Canyon was doing. That was a big mistake. In 1987, actually, I was only 40 years old. I'm 65 now, and climbing into that crater was a big mistake. Darn it, killed me. But here you can see the Little Grand Canyon down there behind us. And it was really fun to hang out because 4 of the original 8 of us that were on the original expedition kind of rejoined. It was kind of a reunion. But you can see Mount St. Helens is a living laboratory. See that Little Grand Canyon? That's the canyon. It was 150 feet deep, a quarter mile across, and it goes for 15 miles through solid bedrock in places. I would have told you it took hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years for the water to have carved that canyon, and we know it happened in a matter of hours. The other thing, I have been involved in several research projects. I've been down the Grand Canyon. I worked on the Nautiloid Research Project in the Grand Canyon. I worked on the Strata Project. I was one of 12 scientists on the Hansen Research Project. It's a dinosaur dig up in Wyoming where I found this Pachycephalosaurus skull. My mom said that was a great find for me. Pachy means thick, cephala means head. So it was a thick-headed dinosaur for a thick-headed scientist, I guess. But what was interesting, this is what the whole thing looks like when you get it out. But what was right next to that, see if I can go back. Huh? Oh, yeah. After we excavated we found T-Rex knuckle joints, we found Triceratops horns, but just around to the right, I just happened to be looking and I saw a piece of petrified wood sticking out of the bank. So I did what any good lead scientists do. I had my grad students and I gave them toothbrushes and dental tools and told them to excavate it. Yes, I know what grad students are for. I was one. But they started to excavate this piece of wood that was petrified. Well, as they got back on it, it was actually coalified as well. So that's really unusual. To have coalification is a method of fossilization, but to have it all in one piece was really cool. But the last 28 inches of that piece of wood was pure wood. And it was so well preserved that we identified it as a soft species of pine from Canada. Now, remember I told you can't date it once it petrifies, once it turns to rock, but we can date the part that wasn't. And it's found right next to a 65-million-year-old dinosaur, but it only dated at 2,200 years. So you see the problem? But that's the other question. I ask kids all the time, I say, how long does it take to petrify wood? They tell me, anywhere from 10,000 to 10 million years. Guys, I can petrify wood in 1 hour in my lab, 60 minutes. All it takes to fossilize something is the right conditions. Heat, water, mineral, pressure. Guess what you get at a volcano? Heat, water, mineral, pressure. So it takes the right conditions, not necessarily time. But the students don't know this. So we take the information that we find at Mount St. Helens. Can we extrapolate that over to the Grand Canyon and make some reasonable scientific hypotheses? Yes, we can. That's legitimate. And we find that the strata, and that's where Russell come in. Russ leads bus tours and he leads raft trips down the Grand Canyon. And guys, Willie, he's going to do Age of the Earth and the Flood in a minute. And wait till you see the real science. Now, I'm going to skip by this because I want to get to this. Now, earlier I talked about information, and we're going to talk about that. And we talked about the math on the first section. But I also want to talk about the fact that we found soft tissue, red blood cells, skin, and tendons in a T-Rex. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that red blood cells and soft tissue doesn't last for 65 million years. But this was out of Astronomy magazine, and I had to read it a couple times. I couldn't believe it. Remember that quote I showed you this morning out of the National Academy of Science manual? I didn't make it up. It wasn't from some creationist or Christian. It was the National Academy of Science says if it is not empirical, it is not part of science. Remember that? So now how does this fit with that empirical definition? At some point in the dim past, non-living matter started to replicate itself. Scientists are still trying to figure out how. Well, that's a big empirical. First of all, I thought they had already determined. But it sure explained a lot. My wife and I live in Arizona, and we have a lot of rocks in our yard, and we were wondering where they all came from. I mean, if you didn't laugh at this, you'd go nuts. Well, I talked a little bit about dark matter and dark energy and, you know, where that's supposedly holding everything together, where Jesus says in Colossians that Jesus is holding it all together. But when we start looking at things in comparison to that National Academy of Science definition, if it's not empirical, I love this. It says the idea of inflation. Inflation is the result of the Big Bang. Look at this. It's so compelling. Now, follow with this. That cosmologists, including me, that's the author of this article, routinely describe it to students, journalists, and the public. That's you. It's routinely explained to you as what? An established fact. Yet something peculiar has happened since the inflationary theory in the 30 years since Guth introduced it. As the case for inflation has grown stronger, so has the case against it. But do you catch what this thing is telling you right here? The students, the public, you are told that it is an established fact, even though we know it isn't. To me, that is just blatant lie. So I can tell you, it's a fact that I just won the Nobel Prize. Yeah. Oh, well, I explained it to people that I did, even though I didn't. You know, that's just plain wrong. But that's what the students are being given. They're not even encouraged to question or even ask. It's explained to them as an established fact. That's why we're out here, to just present it to you that there are alternatives. Let's look at both sides. Then if you want to believe it as a fact, that is your business. But let's give you all of the information. This is more of that same. Remember, they accuse us Christians of having blind faith. But yet faith can't be used in the science classroom because that has to be empirical and naturalistic. Well, how about this one then? Scientific American. How can cosmologists claim that the Big Bang Theory agrees with observations as they routinely do? Theorists, look at this, are not unaware of the problem. But they have what? They have faith that they can resolve it and restore the naive inflation of the early 80s that attracted them to the theory in the first place. Many remain hopeful, even though they have been wrestling with this issue, look at this, for the past 25 years and have yet to come up with a plausible solution. Now, how empirical is that? But that's in Scientific American. See, but we can't teach the alternative in a classroom. I get so tired. I just feel like this. Guys, we need to be able to present it all. It is okay for us to have different opinions. That's legal. It's just not okay for me to inflict my opinion on my students as fact. And that's what's happening. Students are being force-fed information. Now, there's something called the knowledge filter. And I told you this morning about, I'm going to show you in just a minute, I want you to watch this little video clip I'm going to show you. You're going to see these canvas bags. I can show you warehouses, acres of warehouses full of these canvas bags. The bags have either a yellow or a red tag, and it's lead sealed, so you can't mess with it. And on the tag, it says anomaly. You know what's in the bags? Hundreds of thousands of fossils. But they don't fit. So they're called anomalies, and they're discarded. So now I can stand up in front of my class, and I can honestly tell them that according to the available evidence, now the available fossils fit in a shoebox, but the ones that don't fit in warehouses. You see how misleading, how deceptive that is? You're going to see those, so watch for them. But you can also see what happens, I'll show you the next clip, when you go against the grain. How many have heard of a polystrate fossil? That's a fossil that crosses two or more layers of the geologic column. And remember, the geologic column is another way that the kids are told the earth is old because, you know, you got the Jurassic and you got the Cambrian, the Precambrian, all these layers. Who invented the geologic column? We did. The scientific community did. To fit our preconceived Darwinian evolutionary mindset. We made it fit. We didn't find the geologic column and then develop it. No, we developed the theory and then made the column fit. That's just plain bogus. But we have fossils that cross two layers, like these 300-foot redwoods. We actually have a whale that we found buried on its nose, the fossil. So if we use the geologic column to date it, then the tail is 2 million years younger than the head. Now, that's the problem, folks. So anyway, watch this clip, and you'll see what they're talking about, the knowledge filter, how knowledge is just kind of filtered out to fit what we want it.
Basically, what you find is something we call a knowledge filter. This is a fundamental feature of science. It's also a fundamental feature of human nature. People tend to filter out things that don't fit, that don't make sense in terms of their paradigm or their way of thinking. So in science, you find that evidence that doesn't fit the accepted paradigm tends to be eliminated. It's not taught, it's not discussed, and people who are educated in scientific teachings generally don't even learn about it.
Do you see how that works? It's a knowledge filter. That's why when I interviewed young Christian men and women to teach at my school, when I interviewed them, they were absolutely stunned at what they didn't know. Getting all the way through graduate programs, some as far as PhDs, and didn't know some basic things. How about the cover of the magazine, New Scientist, this morning? The Big Bang needs to be replaced or fixed. Why? If it's not broken, why fix it or replace it? Darwin was wrong, right on the cover of the magazine. But the kids don't know this. They know there's no problem. Oh, well, you know, the Big Bang, it's been proven. The earth is old, it's been proven. Well, what happens to a scientist that doesn't go along with it, even if they're not a Christian? Watch what happened to this woman, clear back in the 60s. This has been going on.
According to geologist Virginia Steen McIntyre, she was silenced at the height of her career because of her determination to report the facts. In the summer of 1966, a collection of stone tools, including this leaf-shaped spear point, was uncovered at Hoyotlico, Mexico. To find out exactly how old the spear points were, a team of experts from the United States Geological Survey was called in to date them.
When we first began to work on the Hoyotlico site, we thought we had an old site. This was back in 66, and we thought it was perhaps 20,000 years old. And at that time, that was considered a very old age for the site. We did what they call radiometric dates, which gives an actual date range. And we used two different methods to do that. One was using uranium atoms, another one was using little zircon crystals.
When we finally got
the dates and all the different methods we used to date it, it came out to be 250,000 years old. To tell you the truth, I would have been happy with a 20,000-year-old date. It would have made my career. It was very old for the time, but it wasn't so old that it was that controversial. People can take 20,000-year steps. They can't take steps that are over 200,000 years at one time. And I was rather naive. I thought, okay, we've got something big here, but I'm just going to stick with the date. We've got the information. We've got the facts. Let's get the facts out and go on from there. And I didn't realize it was going to ruin my whole career.
According to Dr. McIntyre, because she stuck to the facts, all of her professional opportunities were closed off. She's not worked in her chosen field since. The site was closed and permission for further investigation was denied.
Forever. That's just one. We could go on and on. Maybe some of you saw the movie Expelled with Ben Stein. What happens to scientists that go against the grain? This was the case again. She was not a Christian. The site was bulldozed. And I have pictures of an archaeological site that a D9 caterpillar came in, bulldozed it. They put up chain link fence with razor wire around the top of it. Now, why do you suppose they did that? Because it didn't fit. Just like those bags of fossils, anomalies. You know, that's the kind of stuff that we just want to bring to the attention so that the students, you as parents, grandparents, teachers, you can make them aware that there are alternatives. You can, and it is okay to have a different opinion. You know, and you heard when she said, and we dated it using what? Uranium and the zircon. No carbon. You can't date it using carbon. But here's another cover of New Scientist. One of the things as a scientist to admit you don't know something is pretty tough. Look at this. It says, limits of our knowledge. There are just things we can never understand. Well, why aren't the students told that? They're told that it's a fact and that we understand and know everything. It's all been proven. But I like this. Down here, see where it says instant expert down there? You see it says astrobiology. Now, I had a colleague up at UC Santa Cruz, Dr. David Diemer. Brilliant man. I wish I'd had his brilliance because he obtained 20 years of continuous funding from NASA, from their astrobiology department. 20 years of continuous funding out of your pocket. And guess what he was studying? Life from warm little ponds. You know what his results were? Well, I'll show you later. It says negative, nothing. But here's the deal. Now, did it again. Oh. Maybe I should plug it in. He got 20 years of continuous funding from NASA's astrobiology department. Any of you ever met an astrobiologist? You even know what it is? I didn't. I actually ran into a couple of astrobiologists and exobiologists. That's biologists that study life and outer space. There's some good tax dollars for you. Astrobiology, that can be taught, and you tell me that doesn't take faith? And yet we're accused as having blind faith as Christians? I'm going to skip by this too because I want to get to... This is, remember, Russ pointed out Dr. George Wald. Here he says there are only two possible explanations as to how life arose: spontaneous generation arising to evolution, or a supernatural act of, creative act of God. There is no other possibility. Remember, that's what I told you? It's okay for us to have different opinions. We were created to make choices. But one of the choices that you can legally make is you can choose not to believe in God. That is your right. And if you choose not to believe in God because you don't want to, I'll feel sorry for you, I'll pray for you, but that's your business. But if you tell me you don't believe in God because of all the evidence, the scientific evidence, now I'll argue with you because there isn't any. And that's what George Wald, look at his credentials. Professor emeritus at Harvard, Nobel Prize winner in biology. So he says that there's just two ways. He says, spontaneous generation was scientifically disproved 120 years ago by Louis Pasteur and others, but that leaves us with only one other possibility, that life came as a supernatural creative act of God. But I can't accept that philosophy because I do not want to believe in God. That is his right. But see, he's honest. I can sit down and have coffee with this man. He's an honest man. He says, therefore, I choose to believe in that which I know is scientifically impossible. Spontaneous generation leading to evolution. See, scientists know this. It is a faith. It is a belief. It is a religion. You see, that is okay. Let's call them what they are. Two religions, two faith-based religions, and get on with it. But I wanted to show you that carbon-14 has been shown to be bogus and bad all the way back in, look at this, 1981 in the Anthropological Journal from Canada. They are talking about, it says, no matter how useful it is, though, radiocarbon method is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. There are gross discrepancies, and the chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually selected dates. See, I would send my artifact off to have it dated, and I would pick the date I wanted. And then I would publish, scientist finds fossil 3,000 years old, you know, whatever. But see, here's what I was telling you earlier. Here's how you get million-year dates. Using the radioactive, the uranium method, look at the half-life on uranium. 4.5 billion years. How would you empirically prove that one? But look what you can date with it. See, you can't date fossils with it. The carbon dating, however, look at this. No one stretches it past about 70,000 years. So then how do you get a date of 65 million for Jurassic? You see, those are the questions the kids need to ask. But here's an example for you. Look at this. See those, that hat? That's an English bowler, solid rock. So unless Neanderthal was a little more advanced than we thought, how many million years did it take to fossilize that? How about those stalagmites and stalactites over there that we were told took millions of years to form? Those stalagmites were found in a cave, a mine that was 20 years old. See, if we didn't know that, we'd say it took millions of years for them to form. How about that roll of barbed wire, solid rock, fossilized? So when did the cavemen start using barbed wire? You see, it does not necessarily take millions of years or even hundreds of years. It takes just the right conditions. I wanted to read to you the one there showing that opals and diamonds, you know, they were told it took billions of years deep in the earth with great pressure and that built these precious gems. Look at this. It says, despite the common teaching that it takes millions of years to form opal, Australian researcher Lynn Cram has been growing opal in his backyard laboratory. His opal, shown below, is indistinguishable under the electron microscope from that mined in the field. He was awarded an honorary doctorate by a secular university for his research. All he does is mix together the right common chemicals. No heat, no pressure, and definitely no millions of years. Now, only recently there's been a project that's been around for about 10 years plus called the RATE Project, a group of creation scientists working on radioisotopes in the age of the Earth. In the process of doing their research, one of them decided, well, why don't we check out diamonds? Well, no one, even Christians, creationists, ever even dawned on them to check diamonds for measurable carbon because, remember, carbon dissipates, and Russ, I think, will go into this even more, over a period of time. You know, while things are alive, you know, the carbon is absorbed, then it dissipates over a period of time, no more than about 100,000 years. So there could not possibly be any measurable carbon in diamonds, which take billions of years deep in the earth to form. So why would we waste time and money and damage a diamond to find out? Well, they decided to do it anyway, and guess what? They have now found measurable carbon in diamonds from around the world. So they are definitely no billions of years old, or even hundreds of thousands. But see, these types of things are not being told to the students. How about coal? I was told that it took millions of years of dinosaurs and plants dying and being buried to form coal and oil beds. Guys, coal forms all by itself with no help in weeks. Look at this. Coal needs only weeks, not millions of years to form. It has been known for many years that the most important factor for coalification is temperature. The higher the temperature, the higher the degree of coalification or the rank of coal. The length of time is not particularly important, and pressure actually retards the chemical reaction slightly. But see, the students aren't told this. They just think, oh, well, coal took millions of years. No. How about this million-year-old fossil? You see, that's all we're asking, is that you open your hearts, your minds, and look at it from a different perspective. How many heard, you know, Russ kind of alluded this in his lecture about the feathered dinosaurs? How about this? Archaeoraptor is just the tip of the iceberg. There are scores of fake fossils out there. This is out of Discover magazine. It says, and they have cast a dark shadow over the whole field. When you go to these fossil shows, it's difficult to tell which ones are fakes and which ones are not. I have heard that there is a fake fossil factory in northeast China in Liaoning province near where these deposits have been found of these allegedly feathered dinosaurs. You see, there are other explanations. Remember, I showed you now those bags full of fossils that are anomalies that don't count? Well, check this out. All of the fossil evidence for human evolution between 10 and 5 million years ago, according to the secular world, several thousand generations of living creatures can be fitted into a small box. That's all we have that fit the Darwinian explanation. The ones that fit the creation model that go against it take warehouses. But the kids aren't being shown this. How about this one? This is Australopithecus afarensis. As Russ was pointing, they have just a few pieces of the fossil, less than 30% of the fossil. They determine how tall she was, how much she ate, everything else. But look at this. What they don't tell you, and what is rarely mentioned, is that the fact is that the knee joint was found over a mile away from the skeleton and in strata 200 feet lower. Now, how empirical is that? But look at that fossil picture and tell me how much of that is somebody's imagination and how much of it is real fossil. Where did that pointy head come from, those big rounded eyes and cheekbones? That came from some artist making it. That's not what it looked like. That's what they wanted it to look like. But the students aren't told this. The missing link is still missing. Look at this. It's hard to read. It kind of got scrambled. It says, although the team found no intact leg, foot, or hip bones, they said they have enough evidence to declare the creature a new species, Australopithecus ramidus, from a bunch of broken teeth. But yet, that's supposed to be empirical? Well, here we go. Take a look at this. Discover magazine, right on the cover, look what it says. Brave New World says soft tissue found in dinosaur bone shocks paleontology. Well, here's the article. Look what it says. It says the most significant paleontological find advance of the past 25 years was the discovery this year by Mary Schweitzer and Jennifer Whitmire of soft, flexible blood vessels and cells in the cortical bone of the Tyrannosaurus rex femur. Now, think about that one. Does it take a rocket scientist to figure out that red blood cells, soft tissue, and skin cannot last for 65 million years? Even frozen, it won't last for that long. So what is the explanation? Maybe that it's just not that old? Here's Mary Schweitzer, again, a non-Christian, but a great scientist. Look what she says. See, peer review is supposed to be what keeps us honest. So she sent her work out. She says, I had one reviewer tell me that he didn't care what the data said. He knew that what I was finding wasn't possible. So I wrote back and said, well, what data would convince you? Look at this open reviewer's comment. None. Now, there's a real open-minded reviewer. Now, here's the fun thing. This reviewer was contacted by some members of the press, and they asked him why he was so hard on her. He said, well, it's obvious that something's wrong. And he said, well, why do you... She said, well, because evolution is such a fact. And they said, well, why are you so adamant that evolution is true? He said, because of all the data. Wait a minute. You mean your data, but her data doesn't count. He says, I don't care what the data says unless it's my data. You see, that's just plain wrong. That's all we're saying. Hey, let's give her the benefit of the doubt. So she says, I am a slam dunk scientist. I would much rather have held the paper back till I had reams and reams of data. But without publishing a journal in Science, she says, she could never have hoped for funding. That's the saddest part about doing science in America. You're totally driven by what gets you money or funding. And unfortunately, I have to admit, I was part of that. You know, my beamer and my house at the beach is what drove my science, folks. My accolades, pride. Take a look at this. A stunning blow to evolution's age-old story about dinosaurs. I'll blow that little thing up there. Look what it says. It says, the arrow points to tissue fragment that is still elastic. It stretches beyond belief that elastic tissue like this could have lasted for 65 million years. No kidding. Another instance of fresh appearance, which similarly makes it hard to believe in the millions of years. I'm going to show you a little clip here, and then we'll finish and let Russ take over. Look at this. Here's some of the red blood cells. But watch this clip, and it just kind of sums up this. Soft tissue.
In 1990, a nearly complete specimen of Tyrannosaurus rex was unearthed. Scientists from Montana State University found that these bones were not totally fossilized. Sections of the bone were like fresh bone and contain what seems to be blood cells and hemoglobin, which is a protein that makes blood red and carries oxygen. Now, they're still investigating these controversial discoveries, but common sense would say that if these bones really were tens of millions of years old, then the blood cells and the hemoglobin would have totally disintegrated by now. And the bones certainly shouldn't be fresh.
More recently, in 2002, scientists split open a T-Rex thigh bone and discovered flexible, even elastic, soft tissue meat still inside. microscopic examination revealed fine, delicate blood vessels with what appear to be intact red blood cells and other type of cells, like osteocytes, which are bone-forming cells. These vessels were soft, translucent, and flexible.
The mummified carcass of a duck-billed hadrosaur named Leonardo also turned up in Montana. The preserved soft tissue, covering 90% of the fossil, contained muscle, nail material, a beak, and skin.
His last meal consisted of a salad of ferns, conifers, and magnolias, seasoned with pollen from 40 different plants.
This type of evidence would undoubtedly lead one to realize that dinosaurs probably aren't as old as previously thought. But for those of the evolutionary mindset, they're busy scrambling, trying to prove how dinosaurs and soft tissue survived for over 65 million years. Because, of course, dinosaurs died out way before man came along.
Right.
Right? Right?
Yeah, you see, there are alternatives. And see, just plain old common sense. But see, that's why the students are being taught what to think, not how to think. They're being taught to the test. They're not given the opportunity to question or even to use deductive reasoning and problem solving. Well, we're going to stop here. Russ is going to come and pick it up here. So take just a 5-minute potty break and get right back, because we've got a lot more to cover. And while Russ and I switch computers here...